I'm not usually nervous when I do these things, so I don't know why I'm nervous, but maybe you guys are unusually intimidating, which we'll find out shortly. You can try. Okay, so I never plan these things. I've been doing this almost every year since we started, and I always make it partly about becoming a scientist and partly some bit of science. I hear that you're a great group that I hear from the various people I know who have been tutoring you. I hear very good things. I thought I could talk on the theme of where the frontiers of physics are and kind of give a survey of what I'm thinking about and where I think that let me ask, after the camp so far, how many of you still have the idea or the dream of becoming a scientist? Okay, almost everybody, basically everybody. And how many in physics? Okay, great. Okay, so we have a captive audience. So you might want to know where physics is going. And the most important thing to say is that we're in a very paradoxical, very confusing period in fundamental physics. And when I speak of physics, I'm going to be speaking of fundamental physics. That is the search for understanding what the basic principles are to understand nature, what in old-fashioned language we used to say the laws of nature are. And the search for and the understanding of these fundamental principles and laws. That's what I'm interested in. There are many, many aspects of physics and research in physics that are not about that. For example, in atomic physics, you take the laws of quantum mechanics for granted and you work out properties of atoms and molecules. And there's a lot of interesting, important stuff there. In material science or condensed matter physics, you work out the properties of materials. And there's a lot of important things, both practical things, for example, having to do with climate and climate change and new materials for voltaics or energy storage or things like that. There's absolutely important things to do there. But I want to, and I also sometimes think about those things, but I want to limit the discussion to where are the frontiers of fundamental physics. Okay? And I want to talk in terms of scales. And by the way, I'm happy to be interrupted at any time with questions, objections, statements, etc. So feel free, feel loose. Let me start with what do we really know? Okay. Well, the domains which are relevant are quantum mechanics, particle physics, and cosmology, and the unification of physics. And I'll go in that order. Okay, so with respect to quantum mechanics, you've been doing some basic quantum mechanics here? I understand. Okay, does it bother you that it doesn't make any sense?
Yes. No.
Who was the no? Okay, so why doesn't it bother you? Just to put you on the spot and entertain our friends here.
Because I've read a lot about the different interpretations of
That's very contemporary of you, but I'm comfortable with different understandings too, but none of them make any sense.
Yeah.
Okay, so my view, just a state of view, is that the reason why quantum mechanics doesn't make sense is that it's fundamentally not correct. It's an approximate description. It's a model applicable for small parts of the universe, elementary particles, atoms, radiation, simple problems involving radiation, molecules, etc. It might be applicable. It's applicable for some problems in condensed matter physics. But none of that means that it's correct fundamentally. And what I mean by that is correct fundamentally, because science, in my understanding. Science is never about a final understanding or an absolute understanding of anything. Science is a human occupation. Scientists are a community of human beings who are trying to further our knowledge about nature and the natural world. And every generation inherits a legacy of what's known and has the opportunity, if you go into it, to push that forward. But I'm never thinking about what's the final theory. I mean, I did when I was your age, but I was foolish. I'm never thinking about the end of physics or the ultimate explanation of things. I'm interested in the next steps. What I have a friend, a theoretical biologist, who has influenced me a lot, Stuart Kaufman, what he calls the adjacent possible. What is the world of adjacent experiments, the next experiments to be done, the next problems to be resolved, the next theories to be developed, and so forth. Okay. So my sense is that when I say quantum mechanics is not right, it means that I believe there's a better way to understand atomic physics and fundamental physics. Okay. And I think there is a big field of foundations of quantum mechanics. Much of it to me, and you've probably heard different perspectives on it, but much of it to me is by this time academic, in the sense that it's people who say, I like the many worlds interpretation, so I'm going to defend it against people who criticize it. And then there's a literature of criticism and defense. Or I like Bohm's reformulation of quantum mechanics, so I'm going to study that and work in that. And very unfortunately, two-thirds or more of the field of quantum foundations is that kind of thing. And the thing that I'm sure of, I have no evidence except historical evidence, the thing that I'm sure of is that if an idea has been on the table for 50 years and it's not been convincingly demonstrated, it's probably not a step forward. Okay, and the many worlds interpretation, the Bohm interpretation, all these things are more than 50 years old. Okay. So I take it as the task in quantum foundations to invent a theory of quantum phenomenon which is better than quantum mechanics. And I mean by better, this is science, more predictive, makes predictions for experiments where quantum mechanics makes no predictions, and could be tested and gets those predictions right. Okay. So that's where I'm confident. I'm not sure, because I'm a scientist, but I'm confident about anything in science, that that is the frontier and that that will happen. Okay. In this, just to wave around some authority of famous names, I agree with Einstein, who more than anybody else invented quantum physics, with Schrodinger, who invented the Schrodinger equation, with de Broglie, who proposed that matter comes in waves as well as particles, as among the founders of quantum mechanics. The founders themselves were split as to whether quantum mechanics was a completely acceptable theory or not. Okay. So sometimes this point of view, the funny thing is that this point of view, which calls for a revolution in quantum physics, is seen to be conservative because it was the point of view of some of the old original founders. So people in generations that came after, for example, Freeman Dyson, remarked that in his day, all the older scientists were revolutionaries and all the younger scientists were conservatives. And I hope that won't be the case with you guys. Okay, so and I'm happy to discourse on any of these, but this is my first frontier. So frontiers. Of fundamental physics, and one of them is quantum mechanics. Find a truer theory. Okay. Now, I'm not quite done with quantum mechanics. I have one more question to ask, okay, which is, by definition, a better physical theory, a better scientific theory, opens up a domain of phenomenon that the older theory can't accommodate. and the newer theory can make predictions about. Otherwise, it's empty. Or at least if it's not empty, it's deeply frustrating and unsuccessful. Okay. So the important question is, where is the domain of new quantum phenomena? Where is the domain where quantum mechanics breaks down? Good. Good. So I'm going to put domains over here. Gravity. Okay. Let me tell you a funny story, which is sort of the story of my career. I went into physics motivated by the problems and foundations of quantum mechanics. And in college, I realized that there was very little to do in that area because, unlike now, there were very few experiments that challenged the foundations of quantum mechanics. Now is because of quantum technology is a very different situation. And so I went looking for a place where I might work indirectly towards the problem of quantum foundations and thought about the unification with gravity, the problem of quantum gravity, which then was a very small, under-noticed area of research. And I thought I would work in quantum gravity for exactly that reason, that putting gravity together with quantum mechanics might be unsuccessful, and where it was unsuccessful, one would see where quantum mechanics could be corrected. Okay, so that was basically my research strategy since college, since sort of my last year of college. It didn't work. And it didn't work because what we found, so this is sort of the legacy of my generation to yours, is that it's possible to put quantum mechanics together with general relativity and with gravity. Quite a few steps down the line can be accomplished. Okay. And in fact, it's possible to do it partially more than one way. So the situation is one that I never expected, and I don't know that there's a precedent in the history of science, which is it's possible to four or five different ways, partly, but substantially partly, solve a fundamental scientific problem. So we're left with these, we're not left with, we're confronted with these partly successful ideas. So one of them is loop quantum gravity, one of them is string theory, one of them is causal dynamical triangulations, one of them is asymptotic safety, one of them is causal sets, one of them is emergent gravity. So if you were to enter graduate school now and say, I want to work on quantum gravity, you would be faced with the choice of working on these different partly successful, partly unsuccessful programs. What I deduce from that is that, and of course, what's the right answer? The right answer is you should work on your own, because the responsibility of those people who invented those programs to push them through to the end, but younger people probably have better things to do. The conclusion that I draw is that problems in quantum gravity which have to do with the small scale, with the behavior of space and time and matter on the Planck scales, which presumes you all know about the Planck scales, so I don't have to give you the riff. Yeah. Seem to be solvable several different ways. Problems of, can you put the whole universe into the quantum state, seem to be stuck. So where I think there is a domain of interest, which is cosmology. That is the question of, does quantum mechanics apply to the whole universe? So which would mean that there would be a quantum state representing the whole universe. Or is quantum mechanics an approximation to some other theory which you need to discuss the whole universe? Okay, so that's one answer. Anybody else have another answer? Okay, so what people used to say is macroscopic. That is, maybe quantum mechanics breaks down when applied to a large number of degrees of freedom. And I think that's still a good bet. So the domain is, put it up here, is number of degrees of freedom. So that maybe when you get 10 to the 20 elementary particles together in a quantum state, there are nonlinearities which develop, which are not captured by quantum mechanics. Okay. And I think that that's an interesting place to look, and that's why I think the attempts to build a quantum computer are so interesting, because the attempts to build a quantum computer push into that domain. Okay. Another place that I think is could be the demarker or the boundary between quantum physics and the better physics is the number of copies of the system that there are in the world. That is, things that behave quantum mechanically like atoms come in many, many, many identical copies through the universe. You know, there's something like 10 to the 80 hydrogen atoms. Things that have macroscopic properties and appear to always be in definite states and never to be in superpositions, like you and me and our cats and dogs, have no copies. Please ignore the funny guy in the corner who says that the universe is infinite and each of us exists an infinite number of times copied in the universe. Okay? Those people are not doing science, so just ignore them. So I think the number of copies. Okay. That's a hypothesis that I've been playing with. Okay. Anybody else have any demarkers or boundaries where quantum mechanics might not apply if you push over?
Black holes? Or is that under gravity?
That's under gravity, but I'll write it down. Black holes. Any of these things are things, of course, that I or anybody in the perimeter building could spend an hour or 3 hours talking to you about. But do you mind if we do an overview like this? Okay. I'm just going to throw out one that's just to be really speculative and provocative. Life. Is quantum mechanics adequate to understand what a living thing is? The origin of life, is the origin of life explicable in quantum mechanical terms? Or do you need this better theory to understand biology and, say, the origin of life? Okay. Okay, that's one of the frontiers. Okay. Now, particle physics. So you probably know the story. We have a standard model of particle physics. It explains or models the unification, partial unification of electromagnetism with the weak interactions and the strong interactions. It includes all the known elementary particles, the quarks, the leptons. It is full of mysteries. It has about 27 parameters. We used to say about 19. Parameters. But then we discovered quite unexpectedly that neutrinos have mass, and they also mix. The different neutrino types mix quantum mechanically into each other as they travel. Which means that the energy eigenstates are not quite the same as the eigenstates into which they're created by decays of elementary particles. And so we had to add 9 more parameters, 8 or 9 more parameters for the neutrino masses and mixings. Okay, these parameters are measured. We have no idea why their values are what they are, so that's a big question. The Sterren model, by the way, was written down in 1973, which is before you all were born. Immediately, the idea was to go beyond it, to further unify physics, to explain the value of these parameters, to incorporate gravity, etc. There were immediately, in the 1970s, proposals for how to go beyond the Sterren model. Ideas like dynamical symmetry breaking, technicolor, supersymmetry, higher dimensions, and others were offered, most of them already back in the 70s. These ideas have been thoroughly explored and subject to experiment. All the experiments support predictions of the Sterren model, and no phenomena beyond the Sterren model have been discovered, with one exception. Does anybody know what that exception is? What? No. Experimental discovery. Yes, thank you. Dark matter, which, if it is matter, is, so let's put that on. The only thing we know about dark matter is that it's exceedingly unlikely, that is, it pushes the boundaries of the cosmological scenarios for dark matter to be made out of particles described by the Sterren model. Also, of course, dark energy was unexpected, although it's not clear whether that's called an elementary particle or not. Okay, so now the LHC is running after many, many years of anticipation. The proponents of all those research programs proclaimed that in the first year of running of the LHC, evidence for their proposals would be seen. Okay, last week, the latest data of the 2010 and into 2011 runs of the LHC were reported, and there is no evidence of anything beyond the Sterren model. Okay? So, this is a frontier. The frontier in boundary is energies greater than a TeV, distances, say, less than 10 to the minus 16 centimeters, or maybe that's 17. That's where our ignorance is. Okay? Huge, huge area of frustration. Okay? Imagine what it's like to have been somebody who in 1974 decided to work on beyond the Sterren model physics, and 10, 20, 30, 40 roughly years later, there is no evidence for anything that they've worked on. And I have a lot of, you know, older friends in that situation, in that community. Okay? It's hugely exciting to see what the LHC and other experiments will discover. Okay? But there's a huge caution here about the hubris of theory and theorists. Okay, but that certainly is a fundamental frontier, which has not advanced as far as real discoveries are concerned, except for the dark matter and the dark energy, since 1973. Okay. Now, when I mention a TEV, which is the scale of the experiments at the LHC, there are experiments in the world with much, much higher energy elementary particles. Does anybody know about them? Just what?
Cosmic rays.
Yeah, cosmic rays. So this is accelerated. You should always know that in cosmic rays, we see energies of around 10 to the 20 electron volts. I could do it in my head and embarrass myself, but you're the students. How many TeV is that? Just to see if you're awake. Yeah. Okay, so 100 million times more energy in cosmic rays. I'll come back to cosmic rays. Okay, that's particle physics. Now, I'll do cosmology and then quantum gravity. But actually, while we're mentioning cosmic rays, before we do cosmology, let's do special relativity, talk about special relativity. Beautiful, beautiful theory. Have you learned it? Okay. Could it really be true other than as an approximation to something? Does anybody have a view on, do you think special relativity will be considered to be absolutely true 100 years from now? At some what?
On some larger scales, you don't know.
Well, what, so what scale? Where's the delimiter? Where's the domain boundary? Domain boundary is what we're talking about. Where do you think it could be? Where would you look? Okay, so first of all, somebody said black holes. Special relativity is an approximation to general relativity when you can neglect the gravitational field and the curvature of space-time. So we know it's wrong on scales where the curvature of space-time, where the gravitational field is relevant. It blends over into a much deeper theory of space-time, which is general relativity. Okay. But apart from that, if you turn gravity off, does anybody know where the experimental limits are? Well, but way before you get to the edge of the universe, you run into curvature of space-time. Let me ask it this way. You're all familiar with gamma? Up to what gamma is special relativity tested? So let me say, by the way, you really think gamma is the factor under length contraction that governs length contraction. Okay. Do you really think that physics is the same for observers who are moving with respect to us so fast that our entire galaxy is length contracted down to atomic distance, a Bohr radius? No, yes, no, we don't know. Okay. Does anybody know what the experimental limits on gamma are? How large gamma has special relativity been tested? Okay. What? No, you're thinking about how close to the speed of light.
0.999999
is 7 nines or something.
The LHC is like 7,500.
Yeah, the LHC is like 10 to the 4. It's not that impressive. 10 to the 3, 10 to the 4. Okay, I'm going to tell you, it's in experiments with cosmic rays, with these highly energetic cosmic rays. Okay. And the gammas, which have been tested, are about 10 to the 11. Okay, so that's the boundary of the domain. How have they been tested? Does anybody know? I'll tell you a little story. You take a cosmic ray proton and you accelerate it up to these kinds of energies. Okay? That's a lot of energy. That's roughly 10, this is 10 to the 11 GeV, which means that every proton, cosmic ray proton of that energy, has 10 to the 11 times more energy than its rest energy, which is where the gamma factor goes like the energy over the rest energy of the particle. That's where that comes from. Okay. At that energy, a cosmic ray proton encounters photons from the microwave background. Space is not empty. Okay. And it turns out that at that energy, in the center of mass, think of that going to the center of mass, this tiny little, wimpy little microwave photon in this incredible cosmic ray proton. Imagine the center of mass is almost moving with the cosmic ray. Okay. And in the center of mass, there's enough energy from a collision of a cosmic ray and a microwave photon to make a pi meson. And consequently, there's a scattering, and the proton loses energy. So there's a wall. Okay. Or rather, the microwave background becomes a medium during that significantly, now you have to have enough energy to get over the threshold to make a pion, and that energy turns out to be about 3 times 10 to the 19 electron volts. But if a proton is over that energy, it will shed energy into pions and lose energy and go below that energy. Okay. So cosmic ray physicists didn't expect to see cosmic ray protons with energies over that threshold. That's called the GZK threshold, after some Soviet physicist whose names I can't pronounce, who predicted it would be there shortly after the microwave background radiation was discovered. Okay. So they predicted, if you looked at number of cosmic rays, protons, and energies, there would be a threshold. The number of cosmic rays is falling. It's falling like energy to the third power. Does anybody know why? No, the answer is nobody knows why at all. Okay? But it's falling, and what was predicted is that at this threshold you would get a little bump and then it would cut off. Where would the little bump come from? The bump would come from cosmic ray protons created out here, which lost their energy and fell into there. And that was predicted. Okay. And that was more or less confirmed, but with a catch. The catch is that it takes some distance for the protons to lose energy this way. Okay. And so there's a mean free path, which isn't very far, except in our rest frame, it's further than the center of mass frame. In our rest frame, it's about 80 megaparsecs. And there's a bunch of galaxies closer to us than 80 megaparsecs, including some which are believed to be sources of cosmic, of very high energy cosmic rays. And the big discovery, which is the discovery of the Auger cosmic ray detector in Argentina, is that there are cosmic rays, protons, in this realm. There are some events out here, okay, but they all point back. I'm lying. I'm really lying. Okay, a statistically significant number of them point back to galaxies which are closer to us than 80 megaparsecs. So there's a high correlation between where these very high energy cosmic ray protons come from in the sky and where there are galaxies that might be sources of them. Okay, and that's the best test of, it's one of the best tests of special relativity. Because it turns out that the details of exactly how all those things happen are means doing calculations with special relativity with gamma factors about 10 to the 11. Okay. Now, let me ask you another way to test. Can anybody think of another way to test special relativity? By the way, you know, you want to be a good scientist. This is the kind of thing that you should push yourself on. Like, you know, every night before you go to sleep, you should say to yourself, can I think of a boundary that I could push science behind? Can I think of using, can I think of using something that I know to push? And then when you wake up, see if there's, you have any ideas. And just do this all the time. You should always, scientists are opportunists, should always be looking for an opportunity to push into a new domain, to push knowledge past a new boundary, to invent an idea or do an experiment where something new could happen. Yeah?
I was thinking redshift and blueshift.
Redshift and blueshift, good. That are not, something actually simpler. I'm not aware of any tests of the Doppler shift law. Or any at these incredible levels of sensitivity. Okay. So special relativity has two principles, right? What are the two principles?
Inertial frames to be considered
as. Right, so the relativity of inertial frames? Speed of light is always C. Okay? So here's something you might do. You might say, the speed of a photon, of a given photon, so I'm using gamma now to represent a photon, is C, let me call it V of a photon, is C plus, you want to look for corrections, right? What could plus depend on? What properties does a photon have? Energy, a photon has energy. So plus or minus energy. Well, energy is good enough. Energy is related to wavelength, of course. Okay. Energy, do you guys, are anybody checking dimensions? What? With you can't add an energy to a speed. You can't. No, you just can't add energy to a speed. Look, what you can do is you can divide by another energy, okay, and multiply by the speed of light again. Okay, so. What you could test in an experiment is how big or how small this E0 could be. Right? Because the bigger E0, the smaller the effect. So what you can experimentally test is E0 has to be greater than some energy. That's where a boundary will be. Okay? You got it? Now, can somebody think of an experiment to test that?
What do you actually do?
What?
Are you adding energy to a photon?
It's your experiment.
Gamma ray
Okay, you know too much. Gamma rays, good. How are you going to test this with gamma rays?
Get a satellite.
Get a satellite, okay, and you send both gamma rays from the satellite to the Earth?
They get absorbed by the atmosphere.
Right, so you can't do that. You send them from one satellite to another satellite?
Gamma reverse.
Gamma reverse, again, you guys know too much. Okay, so tell me about how it works with gamma reverse.
Satellite receives information from maybe a supernova or a neutron star colliding or something.
Okay.
And then maybe a black hole colliding would be why you get the ultra high energy gamma ray bursts that are above the high energy limit over there.
I'm talking about gamma rays. We're talking about photons. There are no observations of photons up here at 10 to the 8 TeV, although they've been looked for. Sure, the same experiment looks for photons hitting the upper atmosphere of those enormous energies. My understanding is that they've never been seen. Okay. Let me tell the story. Very long ago, 10 billion years ago, 10 billion light years away, gamma ray burst goes off. The gamma ray burst, we're not sure, but it's something like a collision of two neutron stars that have been spiraling into each other, or two black holes, or a black hole and a neutron star. It makes a huge shock wave, throws out photons. Ten billion years later, a satellite receives a signal. A satellite receives a signal in a range of energies. So the burst, which lasts from a fraction of a second to hundreds of seconds, okay, is a bunch of photons coming in from a highly localized spot in the sky in a range of different energies. Okay, what you can do is look in the data. So here's the burst at low energy photons. Here's the burst at high energy photons. You can make an assumption, take the highest energy photon that you see in the burst. Okay? That would have the biggest effect. Assume that the delay from the beginning of the burst is due entirely to this effect, okay? Which is probably not true, but assume that. Okay? Then you can compute an E0. Okay? What's the time delay? The time delay is the time they travel times the change in velocity, and the change in velocity is E over E0. So you know E, you know T, you know delta T, and you can get E0. Okay? So that's the way the experiment is carried out. Now what you're really doing is you're saying you're not discovering the effect, because there could be lots of reasons why this photon started later, okay? But the astronomers believe that it didn't start first. They've never seen a burst that started with a high-energy photon. Okay, so they believe that this is the minimal minimal delay that could be due to a variation of the speed of light with energy. Okay, so they get a lower bound on E0. Okay. Does anybody know what that lower bound is presently? Okay. It's another domain. E0 has to be greater than 1.2 times the Planck energy experimentally. That's from observations of a satellite called the Fermi satellite. And that's from a burst in May of 2009. Which is a famous burst because it had a very high energy photon that gave rise to this bound. Okay? Now, the Planck energy, remember, has h bar, Newton's constant, the speed of light in it, so it's often thought to be the quantum gravity domain, the place where you would look for a quantum gravity effects. This number is derived experimentally. That's where the experimental limits of this effect are. So if quantum gravity had something to do with a breakdown of special relativity or a modification of special relativity, you would expect to see it from dimensional analysis at about this point. So that's pretty cool. That is, by the time you guys are in graduate school, this might be 10 to the second or 10 to the third, 100 or 1,000 Planck masses, ruling out any simple modification of special relativity due to quantum gravity. Or there might be a discovery. Okay. Now there's actually, photons have another property. There's actually another twist that's a hint to the story. Yes, photons have helicities. They have spin. Okay. So it turns out that it's possible to test the hypothesis that the spin comes in here, which means that a right-handed circular polarization, circular polarized photon will be going faster, because that would have a plus spin, and a left-handed circular polarized photon, actually, I got the sign wrong, but it doesn't matter. Okay, photons have two circular polarizations, left and right, which correspond to the spin, and one would go faster, and the other would go slower. So photons of one handedness would go a little faster proportional energy, photons of another handedness would go a little slower. Okay. That means, if you work it out, that if you measure the plane polarization, that the plane polarization rotates. And it rotates in a way that's energy dependent. And that means that if you're a radio astronomer and you see a polarized image of a radio galaxy, which the radio astronomers do, they see galaxies in the radio, and those galaxies are often polarized. The radio signals from them are often polarized. Okay. And by seeing how sharp that signal of the polarization is when they vary in energy, they can put a limit on this effect. Are you following? Okay. Because the polarization would vary with energy if there was an energy-dependent rotation of planes of polarization. And by that physics, they put a limit of E0 has to be greater than 10 to the 7 Planck energies. That's for the polarized effect. Okay, totally unexpected. And there were actually some theorists who predicted this effect should be about the Planck energy based on some hypotheses about the quantum state of loop quantum gravity, which were wrong. I have to emphasize that the theory part of their calculation was wrong, but they published a prediction. And a few weeks later, somebody who was an experimental physicist realized that their prediction was ruled out, not just a little bit, but dramatically. Okay, so that's where the frontiers of special relativity are. And interestingly, quantum gravity appears to be implicated in the frontiers of special relativity. That is, the experiments are in the regime where you would expect effects from quantum gravity, which is very exciting to me. Okay. So cosmology. What do we know, and where are the limits? Okay. We know that general relativity is very well confirmed on the scales of the solar system, galaxies, except it's not really, because to make it work for galaxies, you have to have the dark matter. But if you assume there's dark matter, it's well confirmed. Gravitational lensing at the scale of cosmology and clusters of galaxies is by this time highly confirmed. which is a key prediction of general relativity. So general relativity, at least on scales up to clusters of galaxies, is pretty well confirmed. There are very simple-minded cosmological models based on general relativity where you make the very simple-minded assumption that the universe is as uninteresting as possible. That is, you consider, just like when you do thermodynamics, and you don't talk about where every atom is in a gas, you just say there's a uniform average energy of the gas, and that's called the temperature. Okay? In these cosmological models, you average over all the interesting structure in the universe. You just say that matter is homogeneously, is constantly distributed through the universe at a given time. And you write a model for how the universe expands. And that model is very successful, assuming that you put in the dark matter and you put in the dark energy, which are big assumptions. But assuming that, the model is well tested. So these are called the Freeman, Robertson, Walker models. And they're well tested out to or back to times of, let me be conservative and say nucleosynthesis. That is, you can follow the history of the universe back to the point where protons interacted with protons to make hydrogen and helium and other light elements. And the detailed modeling of that era where the light elements were made gives, with some caveats, good understanding of the actual abundances of the light elements. The caveats are, I think there are some issues with lithium still, but I'm not an expert about that. Okay, I think there's some controversial issues in the community. But anyway, we can know the history of the universe back to about nucleosynthesis. By the way, in my view, the greatest discovery of cosmology is not one that's usually stated, which is that our universe is out of equilibrium at every era that we understand it. It's out of thermodynamic equilibrium, far out of thermodynamic equilibrium, and it has a history that its structure is always forming, new kinds of objects are always forming. Okay. Our universe is not dull. The entire 13.7 billion years have been eras of increasing formation of structure and complexity. Okay. So cosmology is starting to look like a historical science, something like geology or biology. Okay. And I think that that's actually the most interesting sort of meta-discovery of cosmology. But nonetheless, all of that structure formation seems to fit into a picture of the physics that we know, gravity governed to a good approximation by general relativity. It works back to this time, and it works out to distances on the order of the Hubble scale, which is only as far as we can look roughly, because the universe, if the universe that we can see, quote, began a finite time ago, you can only see out a finite distance. Okay? So there's a finite domain there. Okay, where are the frontiers? What's outside that domain? Yeah? Yeah, this is way before. I mean, I'm summarizing stuff with you guys. So we know this is way before last scattering, but yes. Yes. Looking back, so the frontiers are further back in time. Where is another frontier? Good. I'll come back and ask you how you can explore that, but not yet. What else? Yeah?
The acceleration of expansion of the universe problem?
Well, that's a problem, yes. The accelerated expansion, which is synonymous with the dark energy, is a huge mystery. Yeah, but I'm asking now, sort of, where are the boundaries of our actual knowledge, and where can we look out to see further?
Past the observable universe somehow.
Well, I'll come to that. Okay, but let me put. I have here dark energy. Let me just. Accelerated expansion. Let me put this down. Okay, so far in the future, far away. Because it's very likely the universe is bigger than our horizon. How much bigger, we have no way of knowing. Okay, so further away. Of course, now, the far future is an intriguing area, but I'm going to challenge you to develop an experimental program to investigate it. Okay? Far away is the same. Okay? That is really my personal opinion. Is beware of fallacious science, that is error-prone science, where you speculate about in domains that are not observable. We make speculations that are not checkable by observation. Because we're all people. We know how it goes. We can make stuff up. We're really good at making stuff up. That's why people tell stories to each other. The whole point of science is supposed to be counteracting our ability to make things up by being part of a community that disciplines us to prove things, that comes back at us and says, demonstrate that, prove that. Okay? And it's no scientist ever was alone. No scientist ever did science alone. You can't do science alone. You do science in a community. In a community, you can be a rebel, and you can be provocative, and you can be imaginative. And in fact, the community requires that you be all those things, but the community pushes back and says, prove it. And you can take courses in philosophy of science and read Kuhn and Feyerabend and Popper and all those people, and I recommend reading them after. But at the end of the day, okay, with all the philosophical caveats about what's proof, what's verification, and so forth, okay, there's the sort of good enough. It's solid enough that even an honest skeptic will be convinced by your evidence. And if there are some dishonest skeptics out there, well, there are some of those too, but you hope that they're not too influential. Okay. So let me concentrate on the past, because we have evidence of the past. Okay. And I'm going to give a little hope in a minute for the far future, but so don't despair. Okay. So, what do we know about the past? Before the early universe. What we know is that, assuming the laws of general relativity and the standard model of particle physics, the universe, as you go back, continues to be hotter and denser. And the gravitational field continues to be stronger. Okay. And if we trust general relativity, we know that that process goes to an infinitely dense, infinitely hot, and infinitely strong gravitational field configuration in a finite time. In fact, not a long time before this, if I remember right, about 3 minutes before nucleosynthesis. Okay? So, general relativity predicts what's called a singularity. Everything interesting to measure, that's not true. Several interesting things to measure, like densities and temperatures and the strength of the gravitational field, become infinite. Okay. General relativity itself breaks down, that is, the equations of the theory stop predicting anything. You can't evolve further to the past. Okay. This is called the singularity, or the cosmological singularity, because there are things like it also inside of black hole horizons, inside of black holes. This is called the cosmological singularity. Okay? There's two possibilities. And as far as I know, there's really only two possibilities. Either the real world, because general relativity is just a theory, and the fact that something is becoming infinite might just mean that the theory is breaking down, the theory is wrong. So either there really is a, quote, first moment of time, or something like that. There really is no sense to the universe before this, in which case the singularity is real and there really is, quote, a beginning of the universe. Okay? Or the singularity is not real and the universe has a past before the singularity. Those are the two options. Again, to express a point of view, if the first option is right, then I don't know how science can answer all the questions it raises. Because we'll be left with questions like, well, there was some initial configuration just after the singularity. What chose that initial configuration? Even more troubling, why do we observe one set of laws rather than another laws? Why do we have a world with gravity, the strong, weak, and electromagnetic interactions? Why the standard model? Why all these parameters of the standard model? What chooses them? Okay. And if the universe just begins not too long ago, you understand we're doing observations robustly out to these distance scales and back to these time scales. So this is just a little bit before what we have under experimental and observational control. Of course, a lot happens allegedly in that 3 minutes. The universe goes from as hot and dense as the center of a star to infinitely dense. So any domain of physics which is unknown might come into play briefly. Okay? But it's hard for me to see how all the things we'd like to know are going to get answered if there really is a singularity. So I personally prefer to investigate the hypothesis that the singularity is not there, that it's an extreme event, and it's eliminated in a more robust unification than we have. For example, there is some theoretical evidence that these quantum theories of gravity I talked about remove the singularity, and so there's actually an era of a universe before which is contracting and then, quote, bounces and leads to an expansion. That's just theoretical. Let me emphasize that. Yes?
So that process of the universe, like the big bounce or whatever, is just infinite in time?
No, it takes
it
a smaller...
It never starts, or...
You mean what's before that?
The entire process of the universe expanding and collapsing.
I would be, I don't know.
Okay.
I don't know. You're free to speculate. You're free to construct models and speculate. Okay. There's a variety of ideas and models about that. And let me, maybe I'll end by just mentioning some of the possibilities. So the most natural idea is that the previous, quote, universe or era of the universe was a lot like ours. And if that's so, it doesn't have to be exactly like ours. One of the things that this opens up is an opportunity for laws to evolve, there to be changes in the fundamental constants of this event. But it's a lot like ours, assume, because that's what we have to go on. It's a lot like ours. Then we would look to the far future of our universe to see where the origins of the next universe is. That is, if our universe comes from something, then our universe may give rise to other universes. And how could it do so? It could do so by recollapsing again in the future, and then expanding again. It could do so by doing that many times, because black holes are areas where a little bit of the universe collapses to cause a singularity. So black holes could, quote, bounce. Or there could be some unknown force. Maybe the dark energy is not just a fixed number, not just a fixed energy density. Maybe the dark energy slowly evolves and takes over and takes over and causes the universe to re-collapse and expand again. Those are called cyclic models. So Neil Turek and Paul Steinhardt studied those. The idea of black holes bouncing, a number of people have studied. It's an old idea, which means you should be suspicious of it. I've worked on it, which means you should be even more suspicious of it. Roger Penrose has an idea that maybe the universe in the far, far, far future becomes indistinguishable from the universe close to the very beginning. And you just magically glide from one to the other. That's Roger's last book. Magically, there's some math there, and I don't completely understand it. Although Roger is the most important scientist to work on relativity theory except for Einstein, so I take him very seriously. Okay, so to me, so that's where the far future can be a hint as to the, that is, if our universe, if the past of our universe is like the far future of some other universe, we might hope to observe it. Okay. From this point of view, looking into the past, what we would be interested in are fossils of the collapse, of the previous collapse of the universe before. This could be the cosmic microwave background itself, or anomalies in the patterns of the cosmic microwave background. Okay, but there's a lot of stuff to do there. Okay. Of course, a big question, which is an open question, is whether inflation played any role in the very early universe or not. It's a very interesting hypothesis. There's some experimental support for it, but the same experimental support for it can be reproduced by other ideas and other models. There's a lively controversy about, which is a proper scientific controversy about why, whether inflation, to what extent do we think there's evidence for inflation. But in any case, inflation doesn't get us out of the problem of the singularity. It just hides it, which makes it more difficult to study. Okay, so let me summarize. So those are the frontiers. I didn't actually talk about my own field much, which is quantum gravity, but I implicitly did, because in the frontiers of special relativity, I talked about where the Planck energy comes in experimentally, and I talked about theories or models of quantum gravity which make predictions for special relativity to break down or to be modified. And that indeed is a lively area of research. And I talked about getting rid of the singularity, which is a quantum gravity problem. The other domain that I think of as a frontier, but is more on the speculative end, is the question I briefly alluded to of what chooses the initial conditions for the universe and what chooses the laws. I think those are frontiers questions. And what one wants from that, those are scientific questions. What one wants is scientific answers. There's not some metaphysical scenario. It had to be this way because of blah, 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 blah. Okay? But some physical mechanism that did the selecting that would leave traces and leave remnants or residues by which it could be tested, the idea could be tested. Okay, so those are what I think of the frontiers. Comments, questions?
I have a question about, you know, how you're talking about different quantum gravity theories. So are there, like, just like the string theory, they all ended up being really different ways to view the same idea. With quantum gravity theories, are there, like, are the theories distinctly different from each other?
Yes.
So they're very different.
So far as, the situation is that we understand string theory in a certain approximate scheme, which is called perturbation theory, which is dependent on there being a classical space-time for the strings to travel in, for the quantum mechanical excitations of the strings to travel in. At that level, there are an infinite number of string theories. We believe is the wrong way to put it. Some of us hope, and I used to be in this crowd and I'm not really anymore, but some of us hope that all these different string theories are solutions to a deeper theory, which has been called M theory, or that's good enough. That's one name. No, one name for something that doesn't exist is good enough. and there are hypotheses about the symmetry group of M theory. There are various things that have been studied. I have devoted significant time to trying to construct M theory, but that's where string theory stands. Okay. If we had this unification of the string theories, it would be purely quantum mechanical, presumably. It would not depend on there being a classical space-time background for the strings to move in. And it might be closer to the other approaches to quantum gravity that are successful. The other approaches to quantum gravity treat the space-time geometry as quantum mechanical, purely, which means that it's described in the language of quantum states. Just like in an atom, the electron is in quantum states. The electron is not moving around in orbits. Okay? The orbits are an approximate way that Bohr invented, but there's a much deeper way as quantum states, whatever they really are. And so in other approaches to quantum gravity, we deal concretely with quantum states of geometry and their dynamics in time. And the success of loop quantum gravity and related approaches is that it's able to do that. So-called logodynamical triangulations, quantum gravity, other approaches that kind of spun off from the difficulties of solving certain problems in loop quantum gravity. I used to be very hopeful that there would be a coalescence of these different approaches, but and there are some steps towards that. Mostly steps from the loop quantum gravity side of being able to study supergravities, which are gravitational theories with supersymmetries, which occur also in string theory. And so there may be a common, at least to have some common models to study. But I don't see that at the moment. Well, I don't know. The future is open. How about somebody who hasn't asked a question or made a comment? Because as always happens with groups like this, there's three or four people who have been asking most of the questions. Somebody wants to say something? Okay. Anybody else? Anybody? Yeah?
Has there been any progress with working with the sort of like discrete geometries like spin networks and things like that? Mm-hmm. Could you like, I don't know, talk about that for a sec?
do you know what a path integral is?
I don't know how to do one, but I...
So path integral comes from Feynman's idea that the way to compute a probability amplitude in quantum mechanics to go from some quantum state to another quantum state dynamically is sum over all the possible histories that could get you from one to the other through with some set of quantum transitions.
Yeah.
And in loop quantum gravity, there's a technique developed to do that which are called spin foam models. And there's a lot of recent work on them. And there is some major results which give evidence for, they don't prove, but give evidence for the hypothesis that if a spin foam gets very big, that you can define an approximation to it that looks like a space-time satisfying the Einstein equations. So that you can say that general relativity emerges as an approximation to these. And there's quite significant progress towards that. So we used to say that that was the biggest problem. I would say not all the, you know, the deltas and epsilons have been hammered out, but there's the last 3 years there's some very good calculations which strongly support that, and a lot of work going on in that area. So I'm more optimistic about the quantum gravity than I have been in a while. And I should say very much, I mean, this is due to some, not certainly to my work, to some work of people in Europe, especially in France, in Marseille, in Berlin, a little bit in Paris, and some people here.
Are there experimental predictions coming down the road for new quantum gravity?
Coming down the road is a very generous way to ask the question.
Well, I know a few years ago, Platini talked about glass. Maybe there would be stuff coming out of glass.
Right. Right. So two things have happened. GLASS was launched. It was renamed Fermi. It married the cosmos or something like that. Sorry, that's a bad joke. But I have no idea why it was renamed as soon as it was launched. But the results I talked about are from Fermi. They are probing the Planck scale. So what we were saying is happening experimentally. Now, as far as theory is concerned, there's a set of phenomenological models that don't claim to be fundamental theories that investigate how special relativity could break down when quantum gravity becomes important. Okay. We used to call these doubly special relativity models. Now we have a new name for them because we understood a deep principle behind them, which is called the principle of relative locality, which you can ask me about next year, or next time or something. So there's a nice, rich interplay at the level of phenomenological models between that kind of theory and experiment. Okay. Can those models be derived from loop quantum gravity? Maybe there's a path, there's a very well marked out path to try to do that, but it has not yet been followed through. So we don't know, which is embarrassing. There are some other models of quantum gravity which, however, did predict that there would be effects that this rules out or this rules out. So the idea that the world, for example, is just some lattice which is fixed and not dynamical, and everything really just looks like a big material, and special relativity is just an approximation, that's pretty much ruled out, and that's a good thing. Okay, last question? Okay, well, thank you very much, and good luck.